This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Defining a likely voter. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
As pollsters drill deeper into what voters are thinking as Election Day draws closer, they're faced with a new challenge. In this unusual campaign, who qualifies as a likely voter?
A new study finds that mixing up medical records is common in hospitals and can have deadly results. Find out what's being done about it.
Mascots who entertain us at sporting events are finally getting their own Hall of Fame. We'll identify the candidates on the ballot.
And how Driver Zed is slowly riding off into the sunset, thanks to the likes of Tesla and Uber.
It used to be that almost every state required, when you turn 15 or 16 to take a driver's ed course before you got your license. Now a lot of states don't even require that. So that's one reason it's on the downswing.
MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill on the fading industry of driver's ed. She's here later in the hour. The unusual election cycle is bringing to focus another strange element. How difficult things are getting for pollsters. Wall Street Journal reporter Dante Cheney says the quandary is determining just who is a likely voter in the remarkably atypical 2016 election cycle. Dante, how does this work?
So what happens is when we get closer to Election Day, pollsters switch what they're measuring from registered voters to something they call likely voters. And the problem is, this year in particular, defining what a likely voter is a very difficult task.
And why is that? What's different about this cycle?
What's not different about this cycle? So if you think about how this is different from 2012, we don't have the first African-American at the top of the Democratic ticket. We have the first woman at the top of the Democratic ticket. We have a completely unconventional Republican candidate in Donald Trump at the top of the Republican ticket. And we have two nominees who are among the most disliked presidential nominees in history. So, you know, any one of those factors, if you were to have any one of those factors, you would say, what's this going to do to who the likely voter is? We have all four of them. Hmm. And it makes it very difficult to get any kind of handle on what the vote is going to look like in November.
Does that mean there's less credibility with the polls we're going to see in the coming weeks?
I mean, I think what it means is as you look at each one of those polls, and if you're a real nerd, try to dig in and find out what their likely voter model is, if that's something you can do. But the other thing is, understand that as all those polls come out and you see those wide differences, and there's going to be some wide differences in them, this is clearly one of the driving factors behind that.
Jeez. What about voter enthusiasm? Does that factor in here when you're trying to gauge who these likely voters will be?
So voter enthusiasm is one of these things that some people put a lot of stock in and others don't. And back in 2012, the Romney folks were very excited about Election Day because they thought they had the enthusiasm in their corner. But it turned out that anything that was modeling heavily, if they were modeling like the voters heavily on enthusiasm, turned out that really didn't matter as much as we thought. Look, the thing is that the country's changing. The way we consume news is changing. The way we follow elections is changing. And obviously the composition of the country itself, how much of the country is white, how much of it's Hispanic, how much is African-American, that's changing. All those things together mean some of these old ways we have of understanding the electorate, of what likely voters are, who they are, that stuff is, it's just hard to get right. And in 2016, it's almost impossible.
Mm. We're speaking with Dante Cheney, politics reporter at The Wall Street Journal. All right, so you're a data cruncher too here. How about the demographic changes here that are playing a role?
Look, demographics, as we all know, the look of the American population, where it's from, its heritage, those things are changing. So it was assumed, I think, going into this election, that whites, non-Hispanic whites, which now make up about 62% of the U.S. population, would be declining as part of the electorate. Now, they're down to 62%. It was 69% back in 2000, so that's a drop of 7 points. And if you look at how the votes come out, in every election, white non-Hispanic voters have been dropping. The percentage of the electorate or the percentage of the vote that comes from that particular part of the population has been declining. And the assumption was that would continue. Again, this goes to the likely voter model. So do those demographic changes that are shaping the country as Hispanics are becoming a bigger part of the population and Asians, does that shape who comes out to vote? Remember that Donald Trump has a possibility of upending that because he's drawing attention from this whole different group of voters who maybe didn't vote before, whites without a college education, who he's doing very well with in the polls. Maybe his strength with those voters, plus the not having an African-American on top of the Democratic ticket, means that changes this time around, yeah. And maybe non-Hispanic whites become a bigger part of the electorate.
Wow. Will there be patterns we'll be able to identify as we get closer? Like, you know, will the polls improve or be more accurate?
I wouldn't count on that. But the one thing that would help the polls, I think, is if one candidate really broke out to a big lead. I mean, look, right now we're talking about a race that's realistically probably somewhere between 2 and 4 points.
Yeah.
Clinton probably up between 2 and 4, maybe 5. If she gets a big lead, then these things will be easy to read. If Trump chips away at that further and it gets close and, you know, it gets really deadlocked, then it's going to be almost impossible to really get a sense, because then it really does. The closer it gets, the more it comes down to who actually comes out to vote.
Thanks, Dante. Dante Chinney, Wall Street Journal reporter. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Need a website? Why not do it yourself with Wix.com? No matter what business you're in, Wix.com has something for you. Used by more than 84 million people worldwide, Wix.com makes it easy to get your website live today. You need to get the word out about your business. It all starts with a stunning website. With hundreds of designer-made, customizable templates to choose from and the drag-and-drop editor, there is no coding needed. You don't need to be a programmer or designer to create something beautiful. You can do it yourself with Wix.com. Wix.com empowers business owners to create their own professional websites every day. When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy and free. Go to Wix.com to create your own website today. The result is stunning. Glad you could spend some time with us. A new report from a nonprofit that studies patient safety says patient identification mix-ups are common and obviously can have serious consequences. So what can happen and what's being done about it? Here's Wall Street Journal health writer Melinda Beck. Melinda, explain what's going on.
Mixing up a patient can create all kinds of problems. And unfortunately, it's really very common despite all the efforts to correct it.
I would imagine, though, in some of these cases, I mean, this could be deadly.
Yes. In two of the cases, it was. A patient who was having a heart attack was mistakenly not resuscitated because the care team pulled up the wrong records and that patient had a do not resuscitate order. And somebody else was given an okay to undergo surgery based on the wrong patient's records, and he was found deceased in his hospital room the next day.
My goodness. All right, so is this still happening with, say, electronic files, or is this the old manual system causing problems?
This is caused by all kinds of problems, according to this report. A number of them happened because something went wrong with an electronic medical record, and sometimes that happens really right at the registration point when a new patient may have a whole new record created without anybody realizing that the patient already has a record, and then neither of them are complete. And sometimes a new patient gets entered into an old patient's record, and then you have two patients in the same record, and that can really cause problems. But a lot of these are just simple failures of looking at the patient's wristband, you know, when a tray is delivered or somebody's wheeled off to have an x-ray, or the information on the wristband is wrong. These errors can really run the gamut of the whole healthcare system.
Are all of them preventable?
Basically, yes, according to this report. Probably by the law of averages, there's so much going on in healthcare that something's going to go wrong at some point somewhere. But with very careful protocols in place to double-check all this stuff, and everybody being aware that this is there's a constant risk of this, and it can have horrible consequences, they should be able to be brought to an absolute minimum.
My goodness. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal health writer Melinda Beck. Her story is called Medical Record Mix-Up, a Common Problem, according to a new study. These mix-ups, are there suggested fixes from this new study?
Yes, many pages of recommendations, some of which are really pretty basic, like clinicians who go into a hospital room, you know, now they frequently ask what the patient's name is. Sometimes they say, "Are you Jane Smith?" which is the wrong way to do it, because a lot of patients who are groggy, who may not be, you know, totally focusing, will say yes, even if their name is Mary Pat.
Oh, boy.
So always ask the patient to state their name.
I see. Jeez.
And things like standardizing how patients' names are displayed in medical records could also help quite a bit, because if one record has last name first, and the other has first name first, it can be very hard to make sure that this is the same person, or incorporating photographs in these records, because, you know, a very busy doctor can easily see if he's got a young white woman in the picture and he's treating an elderly African-American woman. Things like that could make a big difference in the busy environment of a hospital.
Well, you quoted a patient safety expert toward the end of your story who said, "I think we are making good progress," which says to me, geez, how bad were things at one point?
It's very hard to get a complete accounting of how often these errors go on. And thus it's hard to know whether we actually are improving. But there's so many systems in place now that it stands to reason that we're doing better in some respects. And there are also systems in which when medications are dropped off to a patient's room, there's a barcode on the medication and a barcode on the wristband, and they have to match before the medication can be left. And that has cut down on medication errors. And among the many suggestions of this report is that both of those systems could be expanded across many other procedures. You know, never give a patient an injection or take blood until you've had a timeout to check that this is the right patient. And don't take them down for a lab test or an X-ray without checking the barcode on that and the barcode on the wristband.
Thanks, Melinda. Wall Street Journal health writer Melinda Beck. It's 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. What do you think our world will look like in the year 2025 from a technology standpoint? Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group, has some predictions about various industries. Rob, what's your crystal ball say about things like drones?
Well, so what's kind of interesting, if we've been watching, is Amazon in particular is aggressive on drone delivery. And if you see these drones, they're pretty good size. And so they could deliver everything short of a large appliance. And if you can have anything delivered, from groceries to batteries to whatever it is you typically go to the store and get, and you no longer have to drive to the store, then what do you need stores for? You used to have distribution centers that are located around town, probably centrally located, very similar to where you have a Costco now, and that's all you've got. No more shopping malls, no more strip stores. Probably a lot less gas stations. You can just stay home, order what you want, and have them come to you. And while we initially have a security problem, because these things drop it off in your front door, much like right now FedEx or a UPS leaves something in your front door, could be stolen. Mm-hmm. In this case, the drone could simply track your phone and deliver the item to wherever you are, which means you could get it. Well, you wouldn't have to be at home. If you're at work, you just step outside and the drone drops your groceries in front of you. You put them in your car, you drive them home when you go home. So the end result is a whole bunch of our infrastructure kind of evaporates because we don't need it anymore.
I didn't even think about not having the stuff dropped at home, but dropping it right to you. Jeez. What about the role that Uber might play or autonomous cars?
Well, so Uber's involved in this as well. I mean, Uber's talking about doing deliveries and certainly delivering you as well. So why would you need a car? In fact, the current model that Ford, Lyft, Uber, and General Motors are all working on is this idea that you won't buy a car anymore. You might subscribe to a car service. You might use Uber the way it is right now. In fact, a lot of kids have decided they don't need licenses anymore. They'll just use Uber to get where they need to go and bypass this whole cost of insurance and car ownership and the rest, and even worrying about parking, because the Uber is adequate for them and far cheaper than car ownership. And we're not even at the point where you get rid of the drivers and you have robots to it, which will drop the cost of Uber rather dramatically. So now you've got a situation where not only do you have an alternative way to get those goods, because Uber is delivering themselves right now, but you have an alternative way of delivering you, and now you no longer need a garage, because what are you going to put in it?
Jeez, right.
And I think you don't need gas stations. You don't need, because the Uber cars will largely be electric.
Right.
So gas stations go away. Garages go away. And all those car dealerships become redundant. So the car dealerships that are currently fighting Tesla, they go bye-bye regardless. So the, yeah. So you're talking about a whole group of folks that probably need to find new jobs.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. His piece is called From Robotic Friends to Flying Cars, Looking Ahead to the Year 2025. What about virtual reality, Rob?
Well, so virtual reality is another big thing that's rolling through, and that allows you to go any place in the world or any place in somebody's imagination and feel like you're there. It's pretty rudimentary now, but it's down at a cost point where a lot of people can afford it. It's only going to get cheaper and smaller. So the end result is now if you want to go on a trip, you want to go talk to somebody and feel like you're there, the HoloLens that Microsoft has, they're currently showcasing an implementation where you can physically visit somebody that's remote and interact with them using HoloLens. And so suddenly all that travel, the airlines, the buses, back to taxis again, and cars, you don't need to do anymore. I mean, you can pretty much now stay in your home. You can visit whoever you want. You can now get your groceries whenever you want, all your supplies where you want. You never actually have to leave your house. You can do your work. A lot of people work from home right now. But you could even do that more readily after we're done. And so suddenly we're all living in our house, and we probably don't ever have to leave. Oh, and by the way, little things like buying clothes. You can simply render how you want to appear, and looking however you want. Maybe no more diets. It doesn't matter if you're 400 pounds. You'll still look svelte to the next person, though it's kind of probably going to make in-person dating a slightly more of a surprise than it currently is.
Right.
But the end result is a lot of these industries that support your image will, to a certain extent, become redundant.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Trips to the post office, as you know, are never convenient. So why not get postage right from your desk with Stamps.com? Stamps.com even gives you special postage discounts you can't get at the post office, including first class, priority mail, express, international, and more. You'll never pay full price for postage again. Here's how Stamps.com works. Using your own computer and printer, buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then just hand your mail to the mailman or drop it in a mailbox. It's that easy. It's no wonder over 600,000 small businesses are already using Stamps.com. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A four-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Get started with Stamps.com today. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com and enter Deal. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal alongside Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, Farewell Driver's Ed. Why supermarkets like ugly produce now, and the Hall of Fame being built for sports mascots. That story in about 20 minutes. There's a new public service advertising campaign raising awareness about learning and attention issues in our kids. The campaign is called Two Sides and shows what learning and attention issues can look like from both the adult and the child's perspective. It's from understood.org in partnership with the Ad Council. We're joined now by Kevin Hager, Managing Director at understood.org. Kevin, start with some of the stats about this.
So 1 in 5 children struggle with learning and attention issues like ADHD and dyslexia. Often those issues go undiagnosed. these kids are just as smart as their peers. They just learn differently. And so we want to help their parents really get in front of these issues, make sure that their children can thrive. This can be a really rough spot of the year. Kids are now back to school, and they're starting to struggle again. So we want to make sure that parents have everything they need to help their kids really work through these issues, get the supports they need, and work with their teacher and the schools to make sure their kids can be successful.
All right, because parents have to be the top advocate here, correct?
Yeah, we think there's nothing more powerful than a knowledgeable, confident parent advocate.
All right, which means what exactly? What are parents expected to do?
Yeah, I mean, first, it's about, you know, helping your child get the support they need and understanding their issues. Many parents don't understand what their kids are going through. I have ADHD, and when I was growing up, my mom just didn't understand why I couldn't sit at the table and do my homework like my siblings. On Understood, we've created different resources so you can actually see the world through your child's eyes. You type in the age and what they're struggling with, and we'll show you what it's like for them to try to sit down and do their homework or comprehend something that they're reading.
Is some of this, Kevin, tied to maturity? Like, do you grow out of this? Or is this something that some kids always have, some, I don't know, do grow out of? How does it work?
Yeah, you don't grow out of it. These are brain-based issues that, okay, you know, stay with you for life. But you can learn to accommodate and learn to really build on your strengths and be incredibly successful. These kids are just as smart as their peers. They just need different supports.
Okay. So different supports might be what, for example?
Yeah, it depends on your particular struggle, and that's what we do with Understood, is show you as a parent, here's what your kid needs, and here's how to get it for them. So if they have trouble, you know, with focusing or paying attention or reading comprehension, we've kind of aggregated all the tools and resources that could be helpful for them, and we show parents, you know, here's what you need to make the right decisions for your child.
We're speaking with Kevin Hager, Managing Director at Understood.org. We're talking about understanding childhood learning disabilities. Are there more kids experiencing this these days?
You know, the numbers remained about the same. There are more kids that are aware of these issues, but so many kids continue to go undiagnosed. They struggle and struggle and never know, you know, that what they have has a name, and it's dyslexia or it's ADHD. Mm. So what we're trying to do with this new campaign that's hashtag Be Understood is really show parents, here are the signs and symptoms, here's how to get in front of it and really see it through your child's eyes.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin Hager, Managing Director at Understood.org. Again, the campaign for social media purposes uses the hashtag BeUnderstood. 22 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for joining us. First weekend in October. The class we all looked forward to in high school may soon be going the way of the dinosaur. We're talking about driver's education. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It's already dying before Tesla and Uber wipe it out completely. Driver ed. If the car of the future doesn't require a driver, will there still be a need to teach people how to drive? Well, Market Watch's Katie Hill is here with some thoughts. Katie, why is driver ed already on the downswing?
Well, it's already on the downswing for a few reasons. One, it used to be that almost every state required, you know, when you turn 15 or 16 to take a driver's ed course before you got your license. Now a lot of states don't even require that. So that's one reason it's on the downswing. Another thing is that fewer people are getting their driver's license, which is happening for a variety of reasons. Some people move to walkable communities. You know, there's some car sharing. But yeah, I mean, that's dropped significantly, especially for people ages about 16 to 44. So much fewer of them now get their driver's license. So that's already, you know, making the driver's ed industry kind of really on the decline for a while now. So that's what's happening. And then we're looking at, you know, the future of these self-driving cars, and you got to wonder, which is why I wrote this story, what's going to happen to driver's ed?
A million years ago, when I learned how to drive, we all learned in school. It was part of the school curriculum, and everyone took driver's ed. Now I think that's changed so much. There are some private companies that are involved. Has that been an evolution that's been underway for a while?
Yeah, I mean, quite a few things are happening. That's exactly right. Right. For us, it's so funny. You think of it as a rite of passage. I mean, it absolutely was. You had to go, you know, sit with the teacher, and you had the yellow car that said student driver on it, and, you know, everybody honked and kind of made fun of you. That's just not the reality anymore. And what's interesting to me with these self-driving cars is the driver's ed industry, which I think they kind of have a point, but we'll see what happens. But they're saying, you know what, you still are going to need to know how to operate all of this technology, and that's what driver's ed is going to be in the future. And sometimes you're going to have to take over. If the technology fails, you're going to need to know how to drive a car. But you got to think, when I talk to some psychologists, they're just like, you know what, people are just not really going to, they're going to be like, man, it'll be fine. The technology will just work. You know, I'm not going to do it. And so probably we're just going to see a massive decline in driver's ed courses.
But as you mentioned, if they do stick around, perhaps they'll change their focus a little bit and teach drivers how to deal with other cars on the road that are self-driving?
Yeah. No, what we think is it'll probably be much more of an online course, and it'll really be focused on dealing with the technology of the car, which, by the way, it's going to, you know, I already have trouble with my car's technology, as do a lot of people I know. So that actually would be helpful. So just the traditional idea of driver's ed, where you get behind the wheel with another human, is probably just going to go by the wayside. The other point, though, is this is not going to happen, you know, tomorrow. Self-driving cars, just, you know, the average lifespan of a car, 11 years most people hold into their car. So if people don't have self-driving cars now, 11 years before they get rid of their car. So you can imagine this is going to be many, many, many years down the road before this totally goes away. And it probably will just change format. You'll be taking driver's ed online. You'll be learning about technology. But yeah, the old student driver, you know, big sign on the car with you sitting there, you know, next to the driver's ed teacher, probably not going to be the way of the future.
I guess I'm just too old school, because I cannot imagine learning how to drive online.
No, I know. It's funny, but that's really where the industry's already going. We're seeing way more classes online. You know, you can take defensive driving courses online. You can take a lot of things online, because, look, people just weren't, they're busy lives. They just didn't have the time to go in and learn to drive like that. So you're already seeing that, and I think it's just going to be more and more and more, to the point where that's just the majority of these classes.
Katie, finally, on a related point, but not exactly the same, the people who drive vehicles for a living, what are they going to do?
Interesting. I mean, that's there was a related story showing how many jobs this could cost. I mean, this will cost people jobs. But, you know, what happens with that? Everyone's like, oh, no, what's going to happen? You know, usually people adapt and they do something new. But, yeah, I mean, this absolutely is going to, you know, Uber actually had their first self-driving car test recently. I think it was in Philadelphia. And you're just seeing a lot more of this. So, yeah, I mean, this is going to cost people who do that jobs down the road.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
Thanks for being with us. Foodies and environmentalists have long appreciated the beauty of things like three-legged carrots and have created a quirky market niche. Now, Ugly Produce is hoping to find an eager new audience in the last place it was ever welcome, the aisles of major supermarkets. The story is from Wall Street Journal reporter Heather Haddon. Heather, take us through it.
This is a look at how big grocers have finally started to embrace the ugly produce movement, which, you know, sounds like a strange phrase. Why do you want to buy ugly produce? But this is something that's really been that's taken off in Europe for some time. Now it's finally coming to the U.S., where consumers are interested in helping to reduce food waste, and also being able to buy cosmetically imperfect fruits and vegetables at a cheaper price. So basically, currently there's, you know, we go to the grocery store and all the produce looks absolutely perfect and beautiful.
Yeah.
But there's a whole category of produce that never even makes it to most grocery store shelves because of a system that deems it imperfect. So in the U.S., the federal government has different grades for produce on you know, how beautiful it is. So there's this whole grade of produce where the fruits and vegetables, they taste good, they're fine inside, but they maybe have a little nick or a ding. And so traditionally these have just, you know, they've been processed, they've been turned into, say, apples go to apple juice. But this is a way to recapture some of those fruits and vegetables, get them into grocery stores and sell them for a little cheaper. So say, again, like an apple that's been damaged by hail, maybe has a little nick on it, will be sold. So a carrot that has three different limbs that traditionally, you know, would have to just be cut up and turned into carrot sticks now can be sold whole. So for some customers, they really like this because they think they're, you know, doing good for the environment. Others like it because it's cheap, so cheaper. So this is still in a pilot phase. This is not coming to every single grocery store near you yet, but Walmart and Whole Foods and some other regional grocers have started to embrace this as a way to both attract a more, you know, ecologically conscious, maybe millennial shopper, and ones who are more price conscious. So they see new markets.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Heather Haddon about her story called Supermarkets Make Stars Out of Weird Apples, Knobbled Carrots, and Spuglies. So what is a Spugly, by the way?
So Spuglies was what one Texas grower of russet potatoes used to call its potatoes that were damaged. I think it was in a particular storm. So just were a little, you know, kind of knobbly, just not what you think of the perfectly oval russet potato, but just as good inside. So they branded them Spuglies, and Walmart has been selling them at 400 stores in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Texas. You know, we still have to see. The companies were kind of tight-lipped about how these pilots are doing. We don't know if this is going to take off yet.
Thanks, Heather. Wall Street Journal reporter Heather Haddon. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. We'll finish with this. There's a Hall of Fame being built for sports mascots. It's going up in Whiting, Indiana. Story in the Wall Street Journal. Benny the Bull and Tommy Hawk, the feathery frontman for the NHL's Chicago Blackhawks, are considered strong candidates for the Hall this year. Until now, the Hall has only existed online to honor legends like the Famous Chicken, Philly Fanatic, and Mr. Met. The museum is the brainchild of Dave Raymond, the original Philly Fanatic. Mr. Raymond, who played the part from 1978 to 1994, is considered by many the best who's ever put on a costume. The next slate of candidates, which will likely include three professional and three collegiate mascots, will be announced at the October 21st groundbreaking for the museum. There are only 125 or so full-time mascots for professional sports teams, and it's a close-knit crew. When Robert Boudouin clutched the bear at Houston Rockets games, got married last year, 20 of his mascot pals served in the wedding party in full costume. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Thanks for listening, and we'd love to hear from you. Leave a review and comment for us on iTunes. For more from This Morning Show, check us out at thismorningwithgordondeal.com.